I think about all the people who don't have the privilege that I have, who I used to serve in the city of Detroit, who I may never meet, but I have the responsibility of speaking for, and I cast my vote for them. So even if you can't vote for Biden, vote for all of the kids that you don't want to be in cages. Vote for all of the people who deserve access to basic healthcare. Vote for all of the people who could die in climate-related emergencies that we fail to prevent. Cast your ballot for them.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I'm extremely curious about what the future holds for today's very talented guest. Dr. Abdul El-Sayed is a physician, epidemiologist, progressive activist, and former candidate for governor of Michigan, and an author and podcast host. He served as Sanders' appointee and one of eight members of Vice President Biden's 2020 Unity Task Force for Healthcare. His recent book, Healing Politics, diagnoses our country's epidemic of insecurity. And he has another book coming out on Medicare for All. He is host of America Dissected, a podcast by Crooked Media, and he previously served the city of Detroit as health director. Abdul was an academic star, earning a doctorate in public health from Oxford University, where he is Rhodes Scholar, and medical degree from Columbia. He was an undergrad at Michigan. We had a great conversation about Abdul's path to leadership and why he's motivated to fight for more equity in this country, as well as about our current politics. You should definitely get to know him. So, after a quick word with our sponsor, my interview with Dr. Abdul El-Sayed of America Dissected.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Abdul, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Absolutely. My name is Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. I'm a physician, epidemiologist, and progressive activist. I was formerly the health director for the city of Detroit, and I ran for governor in 2018 with the privilege of endorsements from Bernie Sanders and AOC. Didn't win my primary, and since I've been really focused on progressive advocacy at the intersection between public health and public policy and politics. I've written a couple books. One called Healing Politics came out in March, and the second, called Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide with Dr. Micah Johnson, is coming out in February. And I also host a podcast called America Dissected, where we explore the ways that our politics and our science are interacting in the context of this COVID-19 pandemic. And beyond that, spend a lot of time really advocating for and organizing around public policy that can help create a more just, equitable, and sustainable America.
You're an incredibly prolific person, so many accomplishments in so many areas. Where's that work ethic coming from?
I don't think I'm doing nearly as much as I think needs to be done. But I know for me, I had a really odd but extremely poignant upbringing. I'm the son of an Egyptian immigrant and the stepson of a daughter of the American Revolution who raised me from when I was three. And so, you know, I grew up in this world of contrasts. And almost every summer, especially in my adolescence and teenage years, I would get on a plane and go 15 hours to Egypt, where I'd be hanging out with my grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins in a very working class part of Alexandria. And in particular, my grandmother, who is this just giant of a human being, smartest and wisest person I've ever met, never got to go to school. And she would imprint her wisdom every year I'd be there, and sometimes some pretty harsh ways, but necessary ways. You know, she'd point to one cousin and say, "That one's smarter than you." Point to another one and say, "You know, that one's better looking and taller than you." You know, point to a third and say, "That one's nicer and kinder and has better humility than you." And her point to me was that, you know, there's nothing special about me. There's something special about the opportunities that I had that explains so much of the difference in the life that I get to lead now from my cousins. And the responsibility to dignify those opportunities and make the most of those opportunities, I think, is so much of what drives me. You know, every day I try my best, but I don't scratch the surface of what needs to be done, I think, to take on so many of the inequities that just my life, in contrast to my cousin's life, demonstrate. There's so much work to do, and those of us who have the opportunities to do it need to bring all of those things that my grandmother's pointing to, you know, that humility and also that work ethic to it.
How old were you when she was making these comparisons with your cousins?
At the height of my egoism as a teenage kid, right? I was 12, 13, 14, 15. And I think those were really important lessons for me to heal right about then, you know, as I was thinking about who I was and who I wanted to be.
When I talk to smart kids, some of them, I think, need that kind of exercise in humility, and some, I think, need the opposite. Do you see that?
Absolutely. You know, I do a lot of teaching. You know, in my work as an educator, sometimes you get these really bright kids who coast because, you know, they don't want to put in the work to excel. And then you get a number of really bright kids who don't believe in themselves and sometimes just don't try. And I think, you know, we owe all of our opportunities a responsibility. And those opportunities that come as a function of external circumstance, the homes that we grew up in and the schools that we got to go to, but also as a function of internal circumstance, the natural gifts that we were given. The responsibility of educators and frankly, good leaders is to identify that thing that someone needs to hear about themselves to help them to be their best and to produce the kinds of outcomes that move in a moral direction the world. You know, all of us have different gifts and different opportunities, and I think all of us need people in our lives who remind us how we can take those gifts and those opportunities and turn them into a world that is just a bit more just or just a bit more equitable or a bit more sustainable for the society in which we live.
I mean, you seem to have come to leadership at a young age. When did you first get this inclination that was a good fit for you?
I got in a lot of trouble when I was a kid, and I found a lot of myself, frankly, and learned myself on the athletic field. I played a lot of sports growing up, and I loved the competition of sports, but I also really loved the camaraderie, the ability to work with a group of people, each of whom has their own strengths and their own weaknesses and their own comportment and own personality, to unite a team around a goal and to help show them themselves in their best possible light. And I really enjoyed that as an athlete, and it started to take on more leadership experiences and opportunities in college and then into the work. But my first real big leadership responsibility was as health director in the city of Detroit. I was 30 years old, you know, frankly, had no clue what I was doing because I was rebuilding a health department that had been shut down when the city of Detroit was facing bankruptcy and state takeover. And my job was to work with folks, many of whom were a lot older and a lot wiser than I was, but to help them believe in what we could do if we came together in the best interest of the people that we served. And, you know, I relish that opportunity and I'm really grateful for what I learned in the role. Some of those lessons about what works and some about what doesn't. But I think leadership it's a practice. It's something that one, you know, develops over time and continues to practice in all the different facets of one's life. And so I think sometimes we overemphasize the leadership that comes in an official capacity and we underemphasize the leadership that we show among friends and in our family. And that doesn't just mean, you know, leading from the front. It also means leading from behind. Because if you believe the idea that leadership is about inspiring the best in people and unifying people toward a cause, right? We're doing that all the time in all of the different spaces in which we live. And I think we need to be really conscious of how we practice that and the tools that we bring to bear on that practice as we live and we learn and we work and we pray and we play, that all of these are leadership opportunities and followership opportunities. And one has to be conscious of that.
Can you just go through that educational background? It's the University of Michigan, a double major in biology and politics, got a chance to go to Oxford, right? Med school, two different places, finished up at Columbia. That's all the preparation for that job at 30. What was it about what you learned along the way that made you go that route rather than a practicing physician?
I took my grandmother's advice extremely seriously. You know, I didn't talk about this, but she had 8 kids and 2 of them died before their first birthday. My father was the oldest of those kids, and he watched 2 of his siblings get buried. The crazy thing about that is that I would travel about 15 hours to Egypt, and in those 15 hours, travel a distance in life expectancy of about 10 years. But I could travel the same 10-year life expectancy gap from where I grew up in 15 minutes going south to the city of Detroit. And that, for me, became the problem that I really wanted to be a part of solving. And I knew some part of that problem was political and some part of that problem was biological, but I didn't really know what public health was when I was in college. So I double majored in biology and political science. But I'd always thought that, you know, understanding the politics would make me a better doctor, and that the way to take on that disparity was as a physician taking care of patients in underserved communities. And as I went to medical school and pursued my training, I learned what public health was and realized that I really wanted to be thinking about the broader structural features that define insecurity and inequity. Also, as I started to work in the clinic as a clinical medical student, came to appreciate the real limitations of the healthcare system that is so driven by corporate profits and has become so inured to the suffering of real people, patients, that we're supposed to take care of. And in some respects, our healthcare system is in fact part of the problem rather than much of the solution. And so I found myself after medical school, particularly after having cared for a patient of mine who was indigent and homeless and had slipped and fallen and hit her head, and just got terrible care in the emergency room. And we admitted her and took care of her for 2 weeks, only to watch her make a decision not to go back to the housing that she had access to and go to rehab for alcoholism, but instead to go home with a daughter. I got on the subway one day about 2 weeks afterwards and saw her laying face down on the subway seats, and decided that I didn't want to be a clinician. I wanted to be focusing on all of the structural features that allow people in our society to have to suffer so much because of systemic racism, because of systemic poverty, and because of corporate greed. And so led my career into public health and ultimately into politics.
Running that department, you kind of already indicated it was quite a challenge. What did you learn about running such an enterprise and trying to turn it around and all of the complexities and politics that are involved?
Number one is that great leaders listen more than they speak. They really are, they're prisms that focus the collective voice of a people into a particular action. You know, as someone who had been a professor for a couple of years before I took that job, I'd become really accustomed to speaking more than I listened. And that job taught me a lot more about how to listen more than I speak. The second is that systems create outcomes. And sometimes we focus a lot on the outcomes themselves and forget the system that created them. And working in public health in a city like Detroit, it's easy to just focus on the outcomes and not to dig deeper into asking, what is the system that underlies so much of the structural poverty, the structural racism that creates the kind of disparate outcomes? Threefold the probability of asthma hospitalization than the rest of the state, fourfold the probability of lead exposure. 30% of kids who get tested for vision deficits will come back testing positive again next year. All of these things, they're a function of a system. And one has to be able to, at the same time, be finding solutions that may not be system solutions, while always digging deeper and asking, what is the system that created this? And how do we focus on the system solution? And then the third thing I'll say is that we focus sometimes a lot more on winning arguments than winning the future. And the work in Detroit, right, is that you couldn't, you know, in a year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, solve all of the problems that exist. But the question becomes, how are we winning the future every single day? And how are we building the relationships with the community, within government, with other sectors in the community to be able to forge the future? Again, digging deeper into the systems problems, but also posing and implementing solutions right now to be able to win that future. And I think sometimes we focus so much on the disagreements that we have with one another. We care to win an argument rather than win the future. And I think we should be focused on winning the future every day.
When I think about ambition, I kind of think there's a healthy kind, which is the kind that you've been talking about so far, which is I want to get in positions where I can make change. And then there's a less healthy kind, which is I want to get into positions where I have a title. I want to be that person. Can you kind of characterize your attitude towards your own ambition?
It's something I've struggled with quite a bit. I've been able to to do things that, you know, my grandmother couldn't have dreamed of, right? You know, when I won a Rhodes Scholarship, I wouldn't even have known how to explain that to her. This is a woman who never got to go to the inside of a classroom. And, you know, I was going to be able to get paid to go to one of the most hallowed universities in the world. One of the things that you come to appreciate about achievement is that in the end, it's almost always empty. I've never found more wisdom than the wisdom my grandmother would ask me. So what are you going to do with it? This sort of mischaracterization of how we ought to live our lives starts really early. We ask kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? As if the position matters the most, or the title matters the most, or the profession matters the most. Rather than asking them, what are you going to solve when you grow up? What are you going to work on when you grow up? What are you passionate about fixing when you grow up, or as you grow up? And I think if we focus our attention on the why and the what we want to work on, the how is very much secondary. And all of these positions and these titles and these awards, they're just a means of how. The why and the what, those are the core of what I think a life are made of. And, you know, the other thing for me is as a person of faith, in my faith tradition, we do meditate a lot on the reality of death. And, you know, as a 35-year-old man, I tend to irk people when I talk about death, but I do think it's really important because, you know, I'm on year 35 of some number I don't know. And if I'm lucky, maybe that's in the 80s somewhere. And if I'm less lucky, that could be tomorrow. And the question that I have to answer is, what did I do while I was here? And how did my having lived change the lives of other people with whom I lived, or other people who may live after I lived? I think when you ask that question, and you put it in the broad sweep of a life, it puts a lot of these accolades and these positions in stark relief. They don't matter. Nobody's going to say you did X or Y, you occupied X or Y office. They're going to say you touched this life, you improved this life, and hopefully not that, you know, you hurt this person. I just think that that's very clarifying, and that approach is very clarifying, at least for me.
I mean, a lot of people who go through the good schools you went through and are kind of exposed to the elite people that are out there, really talented people, very smart people, they lose the way of being interested in ordinary people anymore. What do you think it was that you carried through that kept that continuity or reinforced it?
I hate to keep going back to my grandmother, but the most profound human being I've ever met never got to go to school. That reminds you that, you know, fancy degrees and a lot of time with your nose in a book, while they're, you know, very powerful things in the world, and, you know, one should spend as much time as one can getting more information and learning more, because information and knowledge really are power. Don't forget that the greatest wisdom and the most honest reflections sometimes come from people who have not had to get their inspiration from someone else's words, right? Because they lived it. And my grandmother was that person. You know, she reminded me that every day. And so it is a recognition that the lives of quote unquote ordinary people are extraordinary. And our work ought to be about dignifying those lives rather than trying to dignify the lives of people who've had the privilege of entering, you know, you name the institution or you name the job. Service to me is about dignifying, elevating, and uplifting the extraordinary lives of quote unquote ordinary people. And that's the mission, that's the work. And I also think that there's just so much beauty in the sheer humanity of a life lived. It doesn't matter whose life that is, right? The joy watching a mother and a child interact with each other and giggle at the, you know, silly things that they're doing. The sorrow of losing someone you love, that's something that people go through every day. The, you know, interest in watching a kid learn something new that they didn't know before, and then unlock all of the ways in which that new lesson can allow them to operate in the world and changes the way that they've seen everything else. You know, if you look at those things, those are the immensities in life. You know, the things that we learn in a classroom, or, you know, the titles that we may acquire, if those dissuade us or take our interest away from the truly extraordinary things that humanity offers, I think we're misguided. And so my hope is that, you know, education ought to be a lens through which one asks, A, how do I understand more about those immensities of life? And B, how do I take off some of the burdens that keep people away from being able to enjoy those things in life through the work that I get to do?
I have to imagine that the work you did going to school, learning all these things, reading all these things, added significantly to the wisdom that you took from your grandma. What would you say is in the most profound things that you took from that education?
There's no doubt. Like, I'm really grateful for the educational opportunities that I had. And, you know, there is no doubt that the worlds that they've unlocked in terms of understanding, you know, science and social science and humanities, I just, one cannot overstate the value of that. The best thing is that they provide you a prism and a different set of outlooks to be admiring the same set of things. You know, in medical school, I learned how to really sit down and both listen to and speak with people in pain. I don't practice medicine day to day, but that ability to sit with someone who is hurting and listen to them hurt without putting your own emotions first, and then ask, how do I help you? And how would you like me to help you? And then sometimes, how do I need to help you? Even if it's not the direct thing that you may want right now. I think that's a really, really important skill. And something that I'm really grateful to have learned at the bedside in medical school. And I think about the world of a PhD, one of the most frustrating psychological truths is this Dunning-Kruger effect, where, you know, people with limited knowledge assume their knowledge to be far bigger than people with a lot of knowledge about a thing. And what a PhD does for you is it clarifies just how much work it takes to truly learn some very small piece of a very, very big ocean of knowledge and truly be an expert. And it humbles you to understand not just what you know, but what the process of knowledge attainment and production really is. And then as a teacher, which is, I think, necessarily what comes with education, you know, the word doctor itself actually is a Latin word for teacher. You realize that the most truly human thing that we have is knowledge, because it is not zero sum. Right? If I gave you some of my money, that would mean necessarily that I didn't have that money. But if I give you some of my knowledge, it's not that I lost the knowledge. In fact, the very process of transmitting the knowledge helped me to know that knowledge better. And as we exchange knowledge and information as a society, right, it reminds us that this truly is the most human thing we have, right? The difference between us and other creatures is that we can speak, interact, engage, and our speaking, interacting, and engaging, we have a record of. That is really a beautiful thing. And so I've learned a lot and really grateful for that. But all of that, I think, right, ought to be focused on understanding and empowering the greatest gifts that we have as human beings, which is one another, and doing that in a way that facilitates that human understanding and human interaction. And that really is the work, right? So, for me, that meant being able to pursue these different educational paths and to come out and hopefully advocate for what that world ought to look like. But for my grandmother, it meant taking care of her family and, you know, imbuing her hard-earned lived wisdom on, you know, her kids and her grandkids. And I'm not ever going to say that what I'm doing is more valuable than what she did, because I know that what I'm doing is a function of what she did. And so all of us contribute in our own different ways.
If you are 35 now and you started that job in Detroit at 30, you must have made the decision to run for governor pretty quickly. Can you tell me about how you came to that?
You know, I started my role at the health department in August of 2015, and we got to work pretty quickly, and there was a lot of building that needed to happen in the institution. And as we started to build, it became really clear that so many of the biggest roadblocks were not technical. They were political. And this was my first real run-in with the hard reality of politics. And I was learning about how to maneuver it and how to engage it. And then, you know, I watched Flint get poisoned. I mean, might as well be our backyard. It's 50 miles away. And poisoned by the same system of austerity politics that had shut down the health department in the city of Detroit, poisoned because the state-appointed emergency manager decided to change the water source in a city and poison 9,000 kids, 100,000 people. And then I watched Donald Trump get elected. And at that point, I had to ask myself if the technical work of public health was where I needed to be operating, or if my skills as an epidemiologist and health commissioner, and my story as a son of an Egyptian immigrant, a proud Muslim American, and also the stepson of a daughter of the American Revolution, could remind us as a country who we are. And that was the moment I decided to run. And frankly, I remember very clearly, it was the day I was getting ready to go back to work in the aftermath of the Trump election after the holiday break. And I was putting on a tie, looking myself in the mirror, and realizing that the same zest that I used to have to go to work, I just didn't have. It was because I felt like the work that I needed to do was different. And that was the moment, I think, in my heart that I made the decision to run. From there, it was a lot of conversations with a lot of folks, and nobody really talked me out of it. In fact, a lot of folks were like, this is a unique moment in American political history. And if you feel like you can contribute, you really should. And so decided to officially run in February and launch my campaign at the end of February of 2017.
What would you say is the biggest misconception about that race? I mean, it came through me, through the national media, as one of these left versus establishment races, an elected leader with some history in the state, Whitmer against you with the endorsements that you mentioned. What did they get wrong about it?
Well, there was a third candidate in the race. And this was an extremely rich businessman who had made his money giving passes in his chemical laboratory to the companies that produce these sort of like, you know, over-the-counter sex stimulants or that you find at a gas station. He had been a Republican until he decided to run for governor, at which point he decided that he was a progressive. And so basically took a lot of our talking points and then spent $10.5 million of his own money to put them all over the airwaves. You know, oftentimes when the story gets told, it is the progressive left in my campaign versus the establishment in Whitmer's campaign. But what's lost is the fact that there was a third candidate who, you know, in a lot of ways was confusing the conversation. You know, it speaks to the worst aspect of our politics, which is that it can be bought. You know, if you're a rich person in America, you can buy votes. And that's exactly what this individual did. That is the subtext that gets missed. The other aspect of it is that we are looking at a very quickly changing America, almost like we're looking at it through a strobe light. And, you know, elections are sort of the moments that the light gets shown on where our politics are. And you only sort of see how things move. In 2018 was a unique year. I'm interested in, you know, God willing, in 2020, we have a change in the presidential administration. But we've also had a number of really, really important progressive wins in congressional races and, you know, state house races across the country. And so things are moving quickly. And I worry that sometimes folks say, well, you know, the progressive lost statewide in Michigan. And so you've got a statewide electorate that truly is really quite conservative and aren't open to progressive ideas. And I just think that that is, you know, you're trying to extrapolate too much information from one data point. And I think the world is changing quickly.
What do you think of Whitmer as a governor? I mean, she got a lot of prominence around the COVID. She seems to have been seriously considered as a vice president for Biden. How do you think she's done?
Look, when it comes to the COVID-19 response, I thought she's handled it admirably. When you're thinking about somebody you ran against for a job that you wanted to have, right? I sort of look at it and say, well, you know, it's just fate that the biggest issue in this 4 years would have been a pandemic. And I often think I would have been the only governor in the country who'd ever actually run an epidemic response. I think she's done a great job listening to her advisors and letting the science lead her decision making, and standing up to some of the demagoguery and the politicization of this pandemic from the president and his acolytes. And so on that front, there's very little that I can say that I disagree with. I mean, obviously, there are some technical issues that I might point to, but all told, I think she's done an admirable job. And I'm really grateful that I live in a state that's led by her than some of the folks who've just completely mishandled their responses.
What do you make of the former governor, Republican Snyder, endorsing Biden?
You know, anyone with a conscience who isn't endorsing Biden right now, you know, you have to really ask what they're watching and why. And so, you know, I think good on him. At the same time, I disagree deeply, not just with the governor's approach to things like Flint, but the structural issues that created Flint in the first place. I mean, this was a governor who ran state government literally into the ground. I mean, he sold it off for parts, and decided that it was fine for state government to unilaterally take the rights of local community members to elect their own representatives in cities across our state that were predominantly Black cities, right? Whether it was Detroit or Flint or Benton Harbor out west, this policy of unilateral action, not to operate these cities instead of the mayor or the city council, but instead to address their funding shortfalls at the expense of the operations of those cities and also school districts, I think that philosophy is just so broken. And the consequences in Michigan have been dire. You know, to his credit, I'm glad that Rick Snyder is endorsing Joe Biden, because it's the obvious thing to do if you care at all about functional government. I certainly hope that the end of his governorship has closed the door on the austerity policy and politics that he brought to our state that devastated the lives of hundreds of thousands of people.
You brought up that Dunning-Kroger condition. It immediately made me think of our president. Do you see him through that lens?
That would be a generous perspective on him. This is a man who has subjugated the responsibility that he fell into to improve the lives of 350 million Americans to the narcissism of needing to be right about everything. That is a really dangerous brew. It's never the more dangerous than in a crisis, when you truly do need expertise and you do need people with actual knowledge leading the way forward. And you decide that because you're the president and because you have a pulpit, that what is true to you matters more than what is actually true. And then you proceed to make decisions in accordance with that and your own political interests that lead to the fumbling of a pandemic that's now taken 185,000 lives, and experts say could take 420,000 lives by New Year's. This is deadly narcissism. And so it's not just, you know, the fact that this man extrapolates that he understands something because he read a tweet about it, but it's the fact that once he is proven wrong, he can't back down. And he can't not stand the fact that there are people who know more about things than him, despite the fact that almost everyone around him knows more about things than him. It is this culmination of deadly narcissism, ineptitude, and frank arrogance and disregard for the lives of 350 million people that has led us where we are.
It's rough to even contemplate. You have a book out called Healing Politics. Why did you write that?
You know, I'm an epidemiologist by training, and the work that we do in epidemiology is about understanding the broader patterns that shape health and disease. And if you look at our politics, it's clear that they're sick. It's the reason why I ran for governor. When I decided to run, I thought that I was putting, you know, the epidemiologist in my mind to rest for a while and, you know, becoming a candidate. But on the long drives home from, you know, the furthest reaches of the state, I found the candidate in me conversating with the epidemiologist in me to try and understand why our politics are so sick. And this book is the result of that conversation. In the book, I diagnosed what I call an epidemic of insecurity. And what I mean by that is the anxiety and fear for the future that pervades so much of our conscious, doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you sit on, that is actually driven by the experience of substantial loss over the past 40 years as the institutions that we've relied upon to deliver the basic means of a dignified life have been sold for parts to corporations who care less about providing basic goods and services and care more about whether or not they can profit on them. And so you look at, you know, the failure to provide basic access to adequate healthcare, the failure to make sure that everybody has something as simple as a home, the economy's churn of jobs into this amalgam of automation and offshoring and spitting out gigs that don't come with a basic living wage or basic benefits. A political system that profits people on K Street to the tunes of billions of dollars while suppressing the votes of low-income people across the country. All of these things have left us in this deep state of insecurity. And the only way out of it, I believe, is a politics that really does frame on empathy. And what I mean by that is not the kind of thing where we just say, look, you know, because you're in pain, you're right. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we need to understand why people sometimes behave the way they behave and how this insecurity epidemic may be shaping behavior in ways that are tearing us apart rather than bringing us together. And if we're able to put ourselves in the shoes of other people and ask how might insecurity be shaping their lives, we may understand them better. It doesn't mean that we should allow them to keep doing destructive things. But it does mean that if we were to empathize with why they're doing destructive things, maybe we would all be on a better path to doing productive things and actually solving the systemic roots of our insecurity together.
Do you understand the Trump voter in Michigan?
Yeah, I have family that are Trump voters in Michigan. You got to imagine after Trump was elected, you know, sitting with my aunt and uncle, people who I know love me and love our family, and asking, how could you vote for someone who thinks that people who pray like we do shouldn't be in this country? Their response was that, look, you know, I don't have to care about those things. What I do have to care about is the fact that in the community that I live in mid-Michigan, I have seen nothing but the loss of jobs over the past 8 years, and now they're telling me that the economy is all better. But that's not what people are experiencing. The responsibility we have is to address the fact that for the past 40 years, not just for the past four, our society hasn't really been that great for a lot of people, especially Black and Brown people in urban communities, but also white people in rural communities. And if we're serious about building out the future, we have to be articulating a way forward for everyone. And so I don't sympathize, but I empathize. I don't agree, but I understand. And I think we in our politics have a responsibility to meet people where they are and help them see where we ought to be, rather than to condemn where they are and assume that where we are is somehow better than where they are. And politics has to be dynamic. It can't be stagnant. And I do hope that, you know, in these next 2 months, we do as much as we can to be articulating a way forward that would truly address the structural insecurity that people like my uncle and aunt face, and people like the people I took care of when I was at the City of Detroit face, because in fact, they are the same set of problems.
Who ought to read your book and why?
Well, as an author, I have to say everybody, but I wrote it with a few folks in mind. I wrote it with young people who are really frustrated in this moment about where we ought to go and about where we are. And I wrote it for folks who want to understand why the other side is where they are. And obviously, I'm a progressive politician. I have a particular viewpoint. But I do hope that if folks read the book with an open mind, that even if you're not on the same side of things as me, you may understand why I stand where I stand, and also can understand why so many of us stand where we stand. And if you do agree with me on a lot of the political perspectives that we may share, that you may have an understanding of why others stand where they stand and what it will take to help them see why we stand where we stand. But in the end, I wanted to write a hopeful but honest book. And as a doctor, right, that's the tone you always want to strike. You want to be hopeful but honest. Dishonesty doesn't help anybody, and a lack of hope hurts everybody. And I hope that the book leaves folks with an honest picture of what needs to happen and where we need to go in our politics, but also a very realistic picture of why we are where we are and what we need to do to get out of this.
I saw that you're on that Unity Task Force on healthcare with Sanders and Biden. Can you tell a little bit about what you saw happening there and how you think the outcome was?
I was really privileged to be one of eight people on that task force. Three of us were Sanders appointees and five were Biden appointees. And I saw, you know, people with honest disagreements about how we ought to reform healthcare in America come together in earnest to try and build a platform that finds a space in between and that articulates what could be done under a Joe Biden presidency. Look, Joe Biden's not Bernie Sanders. And as someone who believes deeply in Medicare for All, having written a book about Medicare for All, I'm not satisfied with an answer to health reform that's not Medicare for All. But I am optimistic about what we were able to put together. I am also optimistic about the ability of people who may disagree on the technical aspects and strategic aspects and political aspects of a very contentious issue in America, the ability to come together and hammer something out and move forward. We have to be able, to do the political equivalent of walking and chewing gum at the same time, which is the ability to advocate for where we believe we ought to go and the ability to sit with people who disagree with us and forge out compromises that really are the steps that we need to take to get there. I'll never rest easy in this country until we have Medicare for All. But I also know that what we were able to put together would be a step in the direction forward of many steps that we need to take to get where we need to go ultimately.
Abdul, where do you want to take your career now? I mean, you're cranking out books, you're advocating. It seems like you really were such a strong candidate for office in a big state. What do you want to do next?
I have a 2.5-year-old, and she was born in the middle of my last campaign. As a very wise mentor of mine said, there are a lot of people who can be governor of Michigan or a congressperson from, X district or senator or you name it. There's only one person who can be your daughter's dad, and that's you. I take that responsibility really seriously. And at the same time, I also know that so many of the challenges that we face right now will come to a head in her lifetime. And so, I can't in good conscience father her and not pay attention to the world into which she's walking. And so, that balance, I think, is something that I think a lot about. And Sara, my partner, and I think a lot about. And I also know that this moment is so tenuous in terms of the future of the country. And so I can't say specifically what I want to do, just because I know, as Teddy Roosevelt said, politics is kaleidoscopic and it's always changing as you turn the knob. I do know that I want to be able to do work that does build toward a more just, equitable, and sustainable country, and do work that demonstrates to my daughter that despite the fact that she's ethnically half Egyptian and ethnically half Indian, she's 100% American, and this is a country that that is hers, and that builds out the space where we take on this epidemic of insecurity. Again, for me, it's really the question of the why and the what rather than the how. And my hope is that I can keep finding hows that help to illuminate and solve the why and the what.
If I've taken hope from something during the Trump era, it's that it seems to me that the vast majority of young people celebrate people of different backgrounds rather than look down on them. I have a mixed daughter too, or two of them. I feel like there's been a reaction to the Trump bigotry, and people are learning the opposite from him, maybe even more than the terrible lessons he's teaching. Do you see it that way?
I do. My faith is in God, but my foot is planted firmly on the side of the young people who are making our future every day. I do a lot of teaching. I actually teach at the University of Michigan this term, and the thought and the care and the honest reflection of the young people I get to teach is so inspiring. And so I agree with you. And it's not just that we're building for the world that my daughter and yours will inhabit, but also that we need to be willing to follow them as they build the world that they will inhabit. And I think that that as we think about that future, and we reflect on the people who are going to inherit it, their shoulders are broader than ours. And I'm really grateful for that.
I grew up believing that this was a great country, that we had many problems, and that we were working on correcting them. I think there's an emphasis maybe lately on just how deep those problems have been and still are that may undermine the notion of greatness. It's very clear on the progressive side that we see the world that way. We see a lot of the problems. We want to fix them. And one of the vulnerabilities that we might have politically is a distance from some kind of genuine patriotism. What do you think about patriotism in such a flawed country?
I too believe that our country is a great country, but our greatness is not founded in where we are. It's in our ability to get to where we need to be. And the thing I love about America is not that America is perfect, because it's not. I know that very well as a child of immigrants and an Arab and Muslim American. It's that America corrects, or it has the capacity to correct. And it is in that capacity to correct where I find the truest patriotism, right? Because if you love someone and you see them being mistaken or actively pursuing something that's both hurtful to them and hurtful to others, if you love them truly, you're willing to have the courage to tell them to stop. Those of us who love our country, we love our country because we know that we can have that honest conversation with this country. And, I told you, I spent a lot of time in my childhood in a dictatorship, a frank dictatorship with no democracy. And that is a country that doesn't have the capacity to self-correct. And because it doesn't have the capacity to self-correct, it does not have the capacity to self-respect. And so I love this place. And it is because I love this place that I seek so hard to change it. And I think that is what the essence of patriotism is, particularly in a challenging moment like this one, where on the path to justice and on the path to progress, we have taken a fall. And right now is a moment where we have to get ourselves up, dust off, and continue to walk forward, because too many people's lives are on the line. There are too many issues that need to be corrected. There are too many people suffering. Because I love my country, I love them. And because I love them, I love my country. And I'm willing, I think, to stand up and say something about it. And I think all of us who love our country ought to be willing to do the same.
I have a few friends who were very avid supporters of Bernie Sanders, who are still extremely disappointed by the primary, and who are telling me that they will sit out the election because of that. What do you say to people who feel that way?
You know, on the one hand, I'll say I understand where you're coming from, and I empathize with the pain of working so hard for a vision of America that doesn't get manifested into an election of a particular man for president. But at the same time, I'll also say that there's a lot of privilege in saying that you're going to step aside and you're not going to participate, because the reality of it is that if your leadership is about you, then you're not leading. I think that, you know, we talk about a seat at the table, and you have to remember that your seat at the table isn't about the other people at the table, and it's not even about you. It's about all of the other people who don't get to be at the table for whom you have the responsibility of speaking. And I just think that, you know, folks who can walk away from this election like it's some sort of gain, or it's like this some sort of abstract concept, don't understand the lives of real people on the back end of this election, where you're talking about differences in whether or not they may have Medicaid expansion repealed on them, or they may have access to more healthcare through something like a public option, even if it's not Medicare for all. You don't understand the fact that on the back end of this election, there are kids who will be put in cages, or kids who will be allowed to finally have their Americanness as DACA recipients dignified, given the fact that they are American in every way except for what they says on paper. And you don't understand that on the back end of this election, there's a difference in whether or not we even enforce basic clean air and clean water standards that we agreed upon in the 70s in this country, or we move forward to take on climate change in a real way, even if it's not as fast or as direct as you may have wanted under Bernie. And so to me, I think about all the people who don't have the privilege that I have, who I used to serve in the city of Detroit, who I may never meet, but I have the responsibility of speaking for, and I cast my vote for them. So even if you can't vote for Biden, vote for all of the kids that you don't want to be in cages. Vote for all of the people who deserve access to basic healthcare. Vote for all of the people who could die in climate-related emergencies that we fail to prevent, right? Cast your ballot for them.
That makes a lot of sense to me. In your book, you talk about this epidemic of insecurity. I'm assuming you wrote the vast amount of this before the epidemic of COVID. Is that right?
Yeah. The book was written well before I knew that epidemiology would be a word everybody knew about.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, through that lens of now having COVID, how does that affect how you think about that book? Do you think you got it right using that sort of metaphor or not?
I think about the epidemic of insecurity as the epidemic that sits beneath the pandemic. And, you know, in so many ways, right, the pandemic is a culmination of all of the things that I talked about in the book. I am saddened that the book speaks to our reality right now, because the hope of writing the book was that we never had to get to this kind of a reality.
Abdul, is there a question that I haven't asked that you'd love to answer?
You've been extremely thorough, which I really appreciate. You know, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I really appreciate all the questions that you did ask and the conversation that we shared.
I did too. Really an honor for me. Anything else you want to say?
We have an election in front of us that may define our country for decades to come. You know, we talked about our daughters and the world that they're going to inherit. And this is a referendum on an America that excludes kids like ours, or an America that holds them up and nurtures them and recognizes that they are our future. Nothing short of democracy is on the line right now. And so I do hope that folks are willing to come out and vote for our democracy, to vote for all the people who could be on the wrong end of policies that come out of Donald Trump's next 4 years, and keep working for the things that we want. And the election doesn't end on November 3rd. In fact, it starts, right? Because we elect every day the kind of policies that we will push forward, the kind of pressure we will put on, hopefully, a Biden administration to be able to enact the kinds of policies that really do protect and empower people and protect our globe. And so this is the opening of the every day thereafter that we make the world that we want to live in and that we want our children to inherit. And this work matters. And every single call, every single text, every single engagement that you do matters, right? Because you're building the infrastructure, the social infrastructure that undergirds our democracy. And so let's go out and do that work. I look forward, hopefully, to a time where we can look back and compare notes and talk about all the amazing things our daughters are doing because we did that work.
I agree. Thanks so much. That was Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. He's at abdulelsayed.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.